live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Radio Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, and Pinterest, Neil Haley. And I'm so excited to welcome, first of all, my co-host, Blake Robinson. Blake, how are you today?
Fine, thanks, Neil. It's a pleasure to be with you here.
Absolutely, Blake. We're excited to have you on the show, and we have such a fantastic guest. I'm so excited to welcome the program. And I was a huge fan of his. He had an unbelievable career, Pro Bowler in 1998. He won the NFC rushing title in 1998. He was an NFC champion, former Atlanta Falcon, Jamal Anderson. Jamal, how are you, man?
I'm good. How you guys doing?
We're doing fantastic, and we appreciate
you very well
being on the show. Now, Jamal, I tell you, for our listeners out there, remembering when you were at your peak playing for the Falcons, you were unstoppable, weren't you?
You know, I'd like to think that when I came to play on Sundays, I put myself in a position to be as successful as possible. It's tough to say unstoppable, but we sure had a good time. And, you know, for me, when I got into the NFL, I was right behind, you guys know, living in this area, I was a year or two behind Jerome Bettis. So that guy, when his explosion into league, it really helped me out immensely and opened people's eyes to the fact that, you know, big backs could also be versatile and could really steer offenses. So it was awesome, and I really, you know, I think we had a lot of fun and we're great teammates. So I was very fortunate.
Definitely, and I think the big backs, definitely Jerome brought back the big backs from the days of Earl Campbell in so many ways. So Jamal, when you were growing up, did you always want to be a football player?
You know, I did. It was weird. I'm kind of I have this funny hashtag with all the people that follow me on, you know, Twitter. And everybody calls me the Dirty Bird, but I always say the Nerdy Bird. So, interestingly enough, I wrote like an essay when I was like 9 years old about my desire to be a Fortune 500 CEO while I was playing in the NFL and winning a Super Bowl. I was a rather ambitious child, so yes, I thought if you would have asked me at, you know, 9, 10 years old, I already had in my head that I was gonna make it to the NFL and this whole plan laid out. So I've loved football for as long as I can remember, and still love to watch the game. I am completely fired up for the season. It's weird. It's been a long couple of months, if we think back, but it almost is like, it seems like it just ended, but no, it didn't. If you go through like the timeline of news events, we've waited a long time for the football season to come, and thankfully it's here. And it's a trip because I'm a big soccer fan, and obviously everybody was World Cup, and it's weird when you turn on those TVs and see those beautiful grass fields and you guys flopping. You know what I mean? I'm like, I can't wait till we use the field to hit people for real, you know?
Yeah, in the NFL season, Blake, it just seems like it's such a short season compared to all the other seasons. Isn't that true, Blake?
That is true. It has gotten a little bit longer, thankfully, in the last 10 years, if I remember correctly. But sure, compared to basketball, compared to hockey, it's just a couple of months.
Well, you know, the thing is, okay, so we'll start up here in August, and if you're fortunate, you'll end in February. And I don't know, I mean, you know, if you get 16 weeks, but I don't think it could, you know, I know there's this conversation about adding two games. Listen, selfishly as a fan and not as a guy who was an ex player, I'm like, I have to say that. It's like, it has to come with an asterisk. I'm like, yes, give me two more games. Then I think about it as a player and I want to knock myself upside the head, which of course then would give me a concussion, which then of course would not be good. So my thing is, it's a long season, and I try to remember, and again, being a.k.a. the Nerdy Bird, I tried to go back and remember, because I used to keep a journal when I was a rookie, and I remember looking at some things, like, 3, 4 years ago, and I was like fascinated reading my stuff about how, I mean, it's a long season. It's a very, especially when you come from college, which college football seasons obviously have gotten longer, but it's a long season and it's very physical. So I don't, you know, it doesn't seem like it. Obviously there's so many games. We just, baseball and basketball, I personally, and then I love both of them. Listen, I was at a Braves game the other night. I got Hawks tickets. Love them both. It's best in the, all over the place. You know, been following with great interest what's been going on in basketball with LeBron and some of the free agents movements, and I'm a huge hockey fan. My kid plays hockey. But I really think those two other sports could greatly benefit from decreasing their seasons. You know, I think the product is kind of like, and, you know,
I agree, yeah.
So I don't think it'll ever happen because, you know, we're talking about money and TV rights and this, this, that, and the other. But I would, to me, I'm like, God, the NBA, look how great that season was they had. I mean, we don't want to strike, but yeah, look how great that season was they had a couple years ago when it was like 70 games,
yeah,
or
right,
whatever, you know?
Or the NHL where it goes on forever. It never ends.
Right.
When I want to try to get an NHL player on my show, I'm like, oh my gosh, they don't really have an off season. It's like you got to strike when the iron's hot. At least with the NFL,
right,
we know we have some opportunities to get them on at different times. Now, Jamal, when you were playing in high school, and I guess when you were younger, did people know that you had that talent to play in the NFL at that point in time?
You know, my dad, which was, rest in peace, he was awesome, and he used to record my game. He used to record our games and stuff. And I remember NFL Films did a special a couple years ago, and they were like asking for all kinds of footage, and my parents sent them some footage. I was a pretty dominant, like at 9 years old, I was doing like stiff arms and spins and running children over like it was not fair. Not to be honest, you know, I was pretty. You know, but a lot of things can happen, you know. I mean, I have my son right now is 9. He had an exceptional season last year, but I'm like, people are like, and we're in Georgia. I thought the hype here is outrageous because he's my kid, but I'm like, he's got like 10 years, and he loves baseball. You know, I don't care what he does, but, yeah, I was really, like I said, I was fortunate to have some skills early.
So they knew.
Well, was there a point where you knew that the NFL dream was a real possibility?
You know,
maybe in high school, maybe in.
Yeah. Well, when I got to high school, I would say to people, you know, I'm 4 years away. You know, I'd be like, I'm like 4 years away from the pros. So I got to start thinking. People are like, oh, what are you talking about? I mean, I'm 16 years old. I'm like, yeah, you know, by the way, the way I'm looking at it, you know, I figured I'd go not really red shirt and just go play and get out of there early. I was like, yeah, I'll be in the pros by the time I'm like 21, you know, at least. So people, you know, some people, for the most part at that time, I was a pretty good football player and generating some interest nationally. So, you know, you never know. But there's so many guys, you just don't know. I really say to a lot of guys that so many things, truly, not just your ability and your desire and your intelligence and will, so many things have to fall into place to make it to this level. And so you just don't know. But I really believe that I had an opportunity to do it, and that was what I was going for, and that was, you know, I just look back and go, I'm glad it worked out, you know?
We're talking to Jamal Anderson. I guess we can just say not just a superstar NFL player, but also an entrepreneur. And knowing as a child he wanted to be an entrepreneur, which is, I think, is really cool in a lot of ways. You had high aspirations for yourself, for sure. So when you attended college and right off the bat when you were playing college football, you said about, you know, hey, I'm ready to get to the pros as quickly as possible. But once you started playing in that next level, stepping up from high school to college, did you see a lot of more challenges than you thought once you got to that next level?
You know, when I first got to, the most difficult thing I would say that I faced throughout my career, and that's why I made that comment about Jerome, because it's interesting, we were so close. And sometimes they forget, you know, it's about Earl Campbell and a couple other big backs here and there who were good players, and Neil Anderson and a couple other guys who were exceptional players. And it's like they forgot. And, you know, the league goes through these little things. It used to go through these little things where the big back was in vogue, and there's a scat back, you know, was in vogue. And so it was kind of interesting. You know, for me, when I got to Utah, they didn't really know what to do with me. You know, they didn't really know what to do with me with respect to what position to play and how to utilize me on the offensive side of the ball. And then, you know, we it kind of worked out. And again, I give credit to Jerome because he was making such noise in when he first got to Notre Dame that on a national scene, people start looking twice at guys who are, you know, similarly built, who have a similar skill set, you know? So I was like, whew, it's nice that he was doing what he was doing. But I was always, my entire career, I mean, I've always been a bit, you know, more stocky and stout. And I used to always say, yo, I look like a fullback, but I run like a tailback. And so I worked exceptionally hard to be a great pass catcher and took tremendous pride in the fact that, you know, when June Jones, and he may say this to this day, he would always say I had the best hands on the football team. I took tremendous pride in my ability to catch. And in 1996, I believe, when they first let me start, I had 50 catches. I spent the whole spring. I remember June saying, there's a lot of things you could do. When the Falcons finally started letting me to play, it was like, oh, what were we doing those first 2 years? And I was like, that's what I was thinking, you know? I'd be like, that's what I was thinking. You know, everything happens for a reason. You don't complain. Maybe it saved my body. You know, so no big deal. But I worked an entire spring and minicamp as a slot receiver. I don't think I probably took 10 carries as a running back. And so I hated that it didn't work out because, you know, everybody had comments and this, that, and the other about the run and shoot. Well, you know, guess what, guys? Peyton Manning and those boys went on to be dominant in the very, very similar offense a couple of years later, you know? So I think if we would have been a little bit more run savvy, it would have certainly benefited June's career. But that was my whole thing. I've always been about, okay, you know, whatever you're going to do, you try to put your best foot forward. And I think I work tremendously hard in my television work on CNN, and when I do radio stuff, I try to be prepared, you know?
Jamal, going back to what you were saying about the length of the NFL season, do you remember from your days as a player what week it really started to hit you in terms of the demands on your body, the demands on the other players?
You know, the point really I was trying to make was when you first get in, you can tell. I felt like, you know, once you get a couple of years in the league, in fact, if you're smart, and I try to recommend the players, I played with a guy named Clay Matthews, and I'm talking about senior, and he was, right. You know, this is 94, my rookie year, and, you know, he was certainly on his way out. But I kind of, you know, my dad worked for several celebrities and Tyson and Muhammad Ali and all these people. So I had gotten used to being a sponge, if you will. And I remember I used to just sit at Clay's locker and ask him all kinds of stuff about football and how did he maintain longevity, blah, 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 blah. And he, you know, and I think if you're smart or if you are a smart rookie, you do those things, you know, and don't come in with an attitude or cocky. But he used to talk about it, getting away, you know, training on your own and then coming back and being fresh and how to be prepared. And obviously you have to be tremendously fortunate to play that long and be injury-free, you know, and he was. But I took a lot of those things to heart, talking to our veterans about it. So after the rookie season and you kind of get used to that long run and no more classes and this is a full-time, after that you get used to the schedule and how it works.
You definitely do in so many ways. And you seem like such a student of the game, Jamal, and I'm very, very impressed by that, especially, but we learned it from your childhood, talking about, you know, how you had these career aspirations, not just for the NFL, but also entrepreneurship. 1998, let's talk about it, because it was your greatest year of your career. Again, I checked Wikipedia. I think of just 98 and think of you as a superstar your whole career with the Falcons, but this is the year, your breakout year. Everything was going well for you. What do you see the reasons why that happened? You know, winning the rushing the NFC rushing title, being a Pro Bowler, getting the opportunity to go to the Super Bowl. Tell me.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I knew when Dan Reeves was the coach, and in fact, Sports Illustrated predicted based on what I did in 96. 96, I led the NFL in yards per carry over Barry, Emmitt, everybody. I only had 100 and I don't know exactly, but I know I didn't come. I didn't have over 175 carries, which is kind of insane. Close to 1,100 yards, again, 50 catches for 500 something yards. So statistically, it was like, here he comes. Well, we got Dan Reeves in 97, and I remember Sports Illustrated predicted I was going to lead the league in rushing. And I was like, woo! And then I messed up my – I know, winning Detroit week one against Barry Sanders all fired up and nearly broke my ankle. So I nearly broke my ankle in week one, and it just slowed me down until the middle of the season.
Oh, my. So those injuries definitely happened, and we'll talk about that with life after football. So 98, you had the right coach in Dan Reeves, and I'll say that because I'm a huge Denver Bronco fan, so in a Pittsburgher that's a Bronco fan, but, you know, playing for Dan Reeves and all that stuff, fantastic opportunity for sure in so many ways. And, Blake, as you see constantly, Jamal is always working harder to improve and continue to go to the next level, it sounds like, Blake, right?
That sounds very true. What was it like to rehab that ankle? Were you able to put into effect some of the tips you heard from the veterans?
Yeah, no doubt. And here's the most difficult thing about that type of injury when it's not, if there's not a break, you're in that severe sprain category. It feels like your ankle swells, everything. It feels awful. But you just got to wait and be patient. And, you know, at the time, frankly, our coaches and most people, and in fact myself, you know, you believe and you worked to be that option. And I remember we drafted Byron Hansparth, and we were supposed to be this 1-2 punch. And fantastic, fantastic teammate, by the way, fantastic guy. He was a great returner for us, and he ended up getting hurt, tearing up his knee, and it just affected him greatly. So I was still even kind of hobbling, the best option, but you learn when you get more patient, when you get more mature, that you got to take your time to come back from things like that, and that's one thing that I did definitely learn.
So basically, that great year, then the career-ending injury. Did you were expecting to play a lot more years in the NFL, correct? And just tell
to
me specifically.
Yeah, my football idol, and the reason I wear 32 was Jim Brown. Unlike most kids at 6 or 7, I was a huge comic book fan, and I got my cartoon on here and there. But I used to be glued to the TV. Listen, if I could have had an iPod of John Facenda reading me bedtime stories, I would have done it. You know, the voice of the NFL for so many years.
Yes, yes.
So I was, like, glued to the TV watching guys like, you know, Marion Motley and Jim Brown. And that's kind of how I came up. That was my mentality. Like Bronco Nagurski, these, you know, Zonka, old-school bruisers. Like, to me, and I remember commenting, it was a bad game if I was walking out of a stadium without some sort of blood or dirt. I mean, if I wasn't filthy coming out of a grass field, I'm like, you didn't even work today, you know?
Yes.
What did you even show up for, buddy? You know? So that was my mentality, you know, and those are the guys I grew up really loving, and that's why I wore 32. So to answer your question, sorry about this long run on it, I thought I was going to be Jim Brown. I figured, like, oh, yeah, like 29, 30, I'll end up in London, and I'll be doing the Dirty Dozen Part 2.
Well, so basically you're at that point, you were looking at the entertainment point of things, so you were already were searching and saying, as we can tell, you're a great personality. Jamal, and I knew that. And when I finally connected with you on LinkedIn and I said, oh, you're coming on my show, I said, fantastic, because you'll be one of the easiest interviews because you're so good on camera. You are definitely one of those, the charisma is fantastic. Wouldn't you agree, Blake? He really knows how to entertain people.
Yes, definitely agree. It's easy to hear you tell a story. That's there's no problem there.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. It has been great. I got to get my kid and these guys. Oh, again, we're in Georgia. We have football evaluations today, and they're like in an hour. And my son and his friends, I got like half the football team at my house.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I understand. So, Jamal, do you have any?
They're flying all over the place. So it's funny.
Okay, so we'll kind of finish up. Jamal, tell us your latest projects. What's going on with you now?
Okay, so right now, I'm going to be broadcasting from training camp for CBS Radio. We shot some things, CNN, and you can catch me on CNN or HLN, and sometimes CNN International. Usually Mondays, Fridays, Tuesdays, it really fluctuates, but you can catch me there as well. Now, you can always reach me on my website, JamalAnderson.com. I actually have a blog. And it's a ton of – I used to write a lot, but as my TV radio schedule picked up, I still do write, and I have a couple things that I wrote on my blog. I still enjoy writing. And also, you can keep up with me on social media. I'm all over that stuff, Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff. Just search Jamal Anderson, and you'll see my big face.
Well, Jamal, we'll have to have you back on again because we definitely have to have a part two. We got to learn about life after football. I'll reach out to your publicist and we'll make sure we make it happen for sure.
No problem, guys. Hey, I wish you all the best of success, guys, in the future. Take care.
All right, take care, Jamal. See
you. Thanks very much.
Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Radio Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor. Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. And Pinterest, Neil Haley. And also, you can check me out on Google+. Same place, Neil Haley. And soon, NeilHaley.com. That's coming very soon, the new rebuilt website. But I'm so excited, first, to welcome the program my co-host, aspiring writer, radio guy, Blake Robinson. Blake, how are you?
Great. Thanks, Neil. It's a pleasure to be with you from Pittsburgh today.
Absolutely. I have to have a co-host from Pittsburgh. That sometimes happens. Other times it's from other places all over the world. But I'm so excited about the success of this couple. Many of you know who Shelley Morrison is. She, again, was from Will and Grace Rosario, and everyone remembers that whole thing and how exciting. She's had a great acting career, but her husband, Walter Dominguez, who was on the program the last time, were starting a documentary. It was in the process of funding and everything, called Weaving the Past, The Journey of Discovery. And what's amazing, these two have had some great success, continue to grow this, and so I'm so excited to welcome the program, Shelley Morrison from Will and Grace and Walter Dominguez. Guys, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Pleasure to be.
Absolutely. And I can't believe it was almost a year ago that we were talking right after the Boston Marathon bombing, and how things have changed for all of us in certain ways. The radio network continues to grow on my end, but also just how successful things have been going with the film and stuff. So, Walter, update us on that. And then I was doing some more research into it after listening to the interview to make sure we can kind of break down more about the documentary, not just the reason of starting it. So, Walter, give us an update.
Thank you. Well, we're very excited because after 13 years of work on a documentary, we are going to be premiering it in just a couple of weeks. On Friday, August 15th, it opens at the Lumley Playhouse 7 Theaters in Pasadena, California. It's a great theater complex. It specializes in independent films. It's in a beautiful area. We're just very excited about it. We have the mayor of the city is going to be introducing the film that night for the audience at the premiere. And we're going to have a number of social justice activists and civic leaders, as well as people in the industry, film industry, present. So, you know, we're really happy about that. It's been a long process, and we're just very proud of the fact that we've reached this point.
We're exhausted, though.
Well, we have 3 weeks to go, so the sprint's only beginning.
I can imagine. Walter, when you started the project, did you have in mind something that would be more than 10 years, or did you envision a shorter project?
Well, certainly I thought it would take less time to do, but the thing is that as we began working on the film and things started to unfold at the same time, there were family crises, which some of that is worked in a little bit in the film. This is a personal journey I take people on. I take people with me as I begin to look for the uncover the secrets of my grandfather's early life. My grandfather was a remarkable man who influenced many people, hundreds of people and thousands, not just me. But for me personally, he was a great hero in my life, and he really came through for me on a number of occasions. And, of course, he passed away some years ago. And I decided that it was time for me to do something really meaningful to be able to find out our family history, pass this on to the younger generation and my family. And as we started doing this, we realized, you know what, this is more universal. People through the story of this particular family, we can bring in universal themes that everybody can relate to. And that has been the case. We've had preview screenings, and people have really responded. People of all backgrounds and ages, men and women, old and young, different ethnic backgrounds, different professions. And it really touches people because it really goes to the core of things. It goes to, you know, all of us grow up in families or have had, you know, family life is very important, whether we had it or whether we didn't have it. It has a huge influence on our lives. And so anyway, to answer your question going long around, it's, you know, it took a long time simply because things unfolded in life. Also, there was no way to know what the outcome was going to be. I was looking for people in my grandfather's life who had been dead 100 years before. Also looking for family members of his that he had lost contact with at the age of 5. And on his deathbed had asked us to please look for his family. And so that was another thing that we were trying to do. And, of course, I had no idea where his family would be. Just a general region, maybe. And so it took a long time for these things to work out and for eventually for us to have enough footage and a story to be able to put together in the editing process, which itself took several years. So there's a lot to it.
definitely. Most definitely. And Shelley, I'm sure how pleased you are, especially when finally now everyone's going to get the opportunity to see this. You've already gotten some accolades, I'm sure you're just enthused because it was your own money. You guys funded this all yourselves. You went out blood, sweat, and tears so you can get this out to the public. And now finally it's paying off in a lot of ways, right?
I'm so proud of my husband. We're going to be married 41 years next month. And 41 years ago, I fell in love with this incredible man, and I have fallen in love with him all over again. He has done a magnificent job, the detail. And this is a hybrid. This is not a straight documentary. It's just not talking heads. This is a story, and it's also educational, and it's funny. And it's heartwarming. And the most important thing about this film and the reason that I'm so proud of my husband is what he's been able to convey in the film is connections. That word keeps coming back to me, connections. today most people don't really connect except on the phone, their cell phone or on the computer. People who do come to see the film, they're having a group experience, and they're all connecting. And after it's over, the young people, they talk to us, and they want to go home, and they want to interview their elders.
That's great.
This to us has been the rewards. I don't know how much money we're going to make on this film. If we can make some of it back, hey, terrific. Then we can finish the second documentary. You know, we're low maintenance. I've lived in the same house since 1946. The most important thing is that the reaction of the people, that's the reward.
Yes.
That was an incredible, it must be incredible to see kids wanting to interview their grandparents. It really seems that these days the youth culture is so attractive that we forget how much wisdom that older folks have. And if your documentary inspires just a few kids to get some of that wisdom, then I'm sure it's a big success.
It's more than that. It's also because of
that
Walter has put into this film. A lot of these kids who are watching this, they keep saying, we didn't learn this in school about the Mexican Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
This, a great portion of this film has to deal with the Mexican Revolution.
And its impact on the United States, because the Southwest absorbed many, many refugees from the Mexican Revolution because it was so violent. So, of course, that's had a huge impact on the United States. So it's really about both countries.
And to find out that his grandfather was one of the early revolutionaries.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I mean, wow. I mean, hello. And then to find his grandfather's family after numerous trips to Mexico. I mean, that's incredible.
Absolutely incredible, and I'm going to point this question to Walter in so many ways. Again, you're talking about, and Blake was talking about, they're going back and want to interview their grandparents and the excitement that they have. But one of the things that you talked about was it's not in the history books. Really, we don't know the story of this revolution and what was going on in Mexico at that time. And as he was going on right now, and what we're seeing with the borders right now. So it really does speak to it in that way as well. I mean, Walter, this is something that definitely can be in the classrooms as well down the line, especially high school students, so that they can understand specifically enough what's happening and why this is happening now in Mexico as well, because of what happened in history and what how your grandfather was involved in this history.
You hit it on the head. I mean, this is highly educational, and it's very important for students of whatever ethnicity to be able to connect their own family history with the broader history, because all of us are products of not just our family history, which is huge, I mean, our DNA, but also the past experiences and the ideas and beliefs and the behavior passed down to us has a huge impact on us, all of us at the moment, but also the historical sweep of our ancestors, what they were living in, the times they were living in, and the things that were impacting them. It brings it to life. It makes history come to life, and it makes it compelling, exciting, and engaging for young people. We had a group at one of our screenings from L.A. City Unified, L.A.U.S.D., public schools, and the high school history teacher brought his students in. It was a fantastic response, and he was very stoked. As a matter of fact, he's going to be helping us to connect further with educators throughout this area to try to make this a component of their educational program. So we're excited about that.
Well, if I can, I was going to say, Shelley, if any way I can help you guys out across the country with my education network as well, not just my celebrity network, but my education network and the connections of schools all over the country to get this film out there, I will.
Wow.
I'll help in any way I can, especially reaching out through Twitter and just the connections I have all over the country, especially good friends in education. They're always looking for great things like this, for sure, because I think that this is what we need in history. Go ahead, Shelley. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that, what you said was perfect. And the thing is that what better way to explore history, to put it in terms of filmmaking? And I think what Walter has done with the film is that he's made the film elastic.
Yes.
And we are still, it can stretch. You can jump from one thing to the other and still hold the people and take them on the journey. You can't get ahead of it. And when you can't get ahead of it, and you have, and Walter is the main character in the film that is taking these people on a journey, and the way that he does it, because that's who he is. He is an amazing human being. Animals, children, everyone just gravitates towards him like a magnet. And he is, people feel safe in his hands, so he takes them on this journey. And if we can reach young people, high school, junior high school,
yes,
grammar school, wow.
College, yeah. Well, you know, it's just, we live in these amazing times right now. There's so much turmoil going on. And this summer, it just seems like, you know, there are wildfires breaking out all over the West, but there are also wildfires of other kinds going on all over the planet. And right here at our southern border, we have this crisis of desperate children and some parents trying to flee, a situation that for them is terrifying and intolerable, and they're just desperate to get out of it. And but looking back through history, we can understand from with this longer perspective, it gives us a whole different point of view. And so we can look at these things that are happening in the present and have a lot more wisdom about how to deal with it and how to come up with problem solving, you know, and not just react from this moment, but see it from the whole totality. And
I think you're hitting the nail on the head there, Walter. A thought crossed my mind. Is there a brief synopsis of the historical impact of the revolution that you want to give for our listeners here who may not get another opportunity to read or learn about this event, which is so important, especially for the history of the Southwest United States?
Well, they should see the film. Hopefully we'll have growing demand.
Well, to get them there, just real quickly, I did years of research, read many books, interviewed a number of historians, wonderful historians, both here in the U.S. and in Mexico, and just spent a lot of time with it. I'm not a historian, however. But in a nutshell, in the years leading up to the Mexican Revolution, which began basically in 1910, 1911, Mexico had become a country where 900 families controlled all the wealth and all the lands, right, and 9 million people were basically incredibly impoverished. Many of them had lost all of their lands in the modernization process that Porfirio Diaz, who was promoting progress in Mexico, which sounded great on the surface, built all thousands of miles of railroads and all kinds of things were done, but it was on the backs of the Mexican people. They didn't share in the progress. So, in fact, they went just the opposite. So as things went downhill economically, they also became, the government became more corrupt, and violence started increasing. People started fleeing. And when the revolution broke out, the revolution lasted a good at least 10 years. And one out of every five Mexicans died as a result of the revolution. That's a lot of people. As a matter of fact, I believe it is the most violent revolution in the world history.
Wow.
You know, in terms of how many people died, the percentage of people. So naturally, people aren't, you know, if you have children, you have your wife and your family, and you're in a situation where you're desperate, you're starving, there's violence, you can't go out on the street because you'll get shot. You can't conduct a life. Even wealthy people had to flee. So the railroads that Porfirio Diaz and the capitalists who invested in Mexico, U.S., and Europe built provided a means for escape for people. And so they hopped on the trains, and they came north. And at that time, the border, the U.S. border was open, and you just paid a small fee, maybe a quarter, to cross the International Bridge in El Paso, for example. And then you'd go look for work. And it came at a time when the West, the U.S. West, was expanding rapidly, and they had a huge labor shortage. So they needed workers for the railroads, for mining, to build the cities and the towns. And so, you know, the labor from Mexico and all these refugees, in a sense, were welcome because they were tolerated because they needed the labor. But at the same time, the Mexicans were coming because they just had to get out of a place that was falling apart, and they needed safety. So my grandfather was one of them, although, as it turns out, his circumstances were a little different because he came with a group of revolutionaries who already had been actively speaking out against the regime, Porfirio Diaz's regime, and so they became the targets of persecution and threats, and they actually had to leave, or they would have been jailed or killed. So,
Wow, yeah, and that's such interesting to learn this history and learn what the Mexican people had to go through. And Shelley, being the executive producer, putting it all together, all of Walter's vision and everything like that, what did you put into this film to make sure that, you know, it's where it is now, and especially and the award, which is really exciting for you as well. But tell us your process in this, learning all this history from watching Walter come up with all this as the executive producer.
Well, I was the bad guy because I was the one who said, no, we can't afford that.
She didn't do that too often.
No, I didn't.
She's a good bad guy.
to tell you what it personally did for me, it brought Walter and I even closer together. I'm no spring chicken. I'm going to be 78 soon. It gave me a whole new career. I had to learn all this technical stuff, and even as we speak, they're changing it. You have to have a DCP, and you have to go to, you know, put it on QuickTime on the hard drive. You know, hello, this old brain is trying it. And then as soon as I learn it, they change it.
Yeah.
So it encompasses so much, but the thing that I'm most grateful to Walter for in this whole process is that he was the catalyst for us to meet the most extraordinary people.
Yeah.
Amazing, amazing people. Villagers, historians, teachers, young people. My goodness, it's been like traveling around the world, meeting all these incredible people, and we were led from one place to another. It's like all the relatives on the other side were saying, we're going to help these kids out, and we're just going to, you know, push them, go in this direction.
Shelley, also, I would like to add, in terms of what it did in terms of history for Shelley, she became one of the crusaders to save a historic church town in the downtown of Los Angeles in the Plaza, which is the oldest part of the city. And they were going to, of all things, is a historic district, and you know, you would think it's preservation of historic structures and institutions down there, and they were going to take this old church that my grandfather had been very intimately connected with back in from 1911 through the rest of his life. They were talking about converting it into a hotel, boutique hotel. There was an actual living church group there, and they had been there continuously. And what was historic about them was that they had done something very pioneering 100 years ago, which was bring Latino immigrants and Anglo-American citizens together to try to solve some of the problems that were so bad down there, you know, lack of sanitation, lack of schools, lack of housing, and all that. And there was this huge undertaking that went on. And it was an amazing thing. And all that history was going to be just whitewashed over because some real estate developers, you know, across the street from Union Station, they see dollars and they want to basically gut the birthplace of Los Angeles. So Shelley got on board, became very vocal, and she crusaded. And I think a lot of the work that we did, all the history work and everything, I think really gave her that perspective. And that, I mean, she's always been a crusader, but I think she really, really saw the historic importance. So we were very involved in, and we saved that church.
Yeah. Awesome.
That's where Rosario comes in.
Yes.
Excuse me. It works. I would have to testify before the city council. And I just, you know, I know a lot of the people on the city council, and I say, okay, now, you got to listen to me. And if you don't, your mother's going to be very ashamed of you. You know, just tell it like it is. Just tell it. You know, what are you doing? Come on, folks, wake up. Wake up. Look at what you're doing. Don't destroy.
That's what they need.
You need to shake them up sometimes. And then a lot of it has to do with humor. That's why Will and Grace was so successful tackling a subject about gays, because we did it with humor. And if you approach people with humor,
right,
and if they don't listen, then you rap them on the side of the head. I'm from the Bronx. What can I tell you?
So now, Blake, growing up in California, did you learn a lot of Mexican history and stuff when you were in school and stuff, being in that area?
Not as much about Mexican history. We certainly focused on the California missions for, I think it was, third and fourth grade. I've definitely been to that area of Los Angeles around Union Station, and maybe I've even seen that church thanks to your work, Shelley. It really is important, in my opinion, to keep some of these older parts of Los Angeles preserved, since with real estate prices, at least, you know, sometimes they go up, sometimes they go down, but when they're going up, it's attractive for developers to grab anything they can, historic or not, to try to turn it into some new condo or whatever the case may be.
Do you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely, Blake. And so I think that's the excitement. So, Shelley's talked about her excitement, wanting to continue to get this story out and get more and more people to see this. So, Walter, what's the ultimate plan now? Okay, after the premiere and more and more screenings, you want to get a lot of different film festivals and stuff with this after that?
Well, we're hoping that 1 week engagement that we have in Pasadena, we've invited, we have a lot of sales agents and distributors for documentaries that have offices in the LA area. So we're hoping some of them are planning to come. Others want to get a DVD screener or see it on Vimeo in order to plug into the networks that are already exist, more traditional ones, plus the newer ones, which are all the digital venues. But, of course, when it comes to documentaries, you always have to go grassroots, and you have to plug into the educators, plug into social justice groups, so wherever the natural audiences are and the people who represent them and speak to them. Those are the communities you want to reach out to. So, yeah, there's more work to do, and hopefully we'll have a limited series of screenings across the country in key areas to get the word out there more, and then we'll make it available for video on demand and for colleges, high school libraries, and so on.
That's tremendous, for sure. So, Walter and Shelley, where's the best place we can find both of you guys? I don't know, Shelley, if you're connected still and on any of the social media on your own as well. But, Walter, where can we find information on the film and everything like that?
Sure.
And then and give us the big dates coming up again, and also information we can find on Shelley as well.
Okay, wonderful. The film has its official website is www.weavingthepast.com, and it's a very rich website. There's video, there are interviews, there are film clips, there's news about the latest opportunity to see it in Pasadena. Also, you can go to Facebook. It's Facebook Weaving the Past Journey of Discovery, and we also have a Twitter site. It's at Weaving the Past.
Awesome. Shelley,
Shelley doesn't have her own Facebook site or her own Twitter feed, but she does have their photographs of her on our Facebook site, and so people who are interested in Shelley can certainly see her there.
Absolutely, Shelley. Again, I loved your work on Will and Grace, and it's always an honor to get to talk to both of you guys. And trust me on this. I want to help get this film out. So we'll definitely have to have a conversation off air at one point in time to see how I can connect you to other schools and stuff, connect you to some people that are pretty high in the education field across the country. You guys are pretty connected in California, but I have connections all over the place, especially areas that have a high Latino population that really want to see this, but also the whole world wants to as well. So thanks again for calling, guys.
Thank you very, very much, Neil, for this opportunity. And it's great to meet you, too. And I just forgot your name.
It's Blake. Yeah.
Well, don't worry about it. All right. Thank you very much, Walter.
Okay, guys. All right, take care. Thanks again. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Radio Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor. Neil S. Haley, Facebook. LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. And Pinterest, Neil Haley. And also Google Plus, Neil Haley. And I'm so excited, first, to welcome my co-host. The first time I've had an Author's Corner co-host since back in the day on Life Improvement Radio. I want to welcome the program, Blake Robinson. Again, Blake, you're having an awesome day of getting to talk to some really interesting people. How are you, Blake?
I'm great. Thanks, Neil. It's a pleasure to be on with you here from the great city of Pittsburgh.
Exactly. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I cannot believe this author's resume and as a chef and just such an interesting guy. You can now watch him on Shop NBC or Shop HQ now. He's a best-selling author, now author of The Paleo Diet, Food Your Body Is Designed to Eat. So I want to welcome the program, Daniel Green. Daniel, thanks for calling. And I am now going to be very interested in this interview because I have no idea about the paleo diet. So thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for having me. You know, a lot of people don't. And when I was first handed this idea by my publisher about a year ago, I suddenly realized, my goodness, this is exactly how I lost 65 pounds. 20 years ago, I lost that weight over 3 years, and I couldn't believe how close it was to really what I was doing. So it was a real good passion. It was something I wanted to get involved with. So I think it's something a lot of people are going to be enlightened by when they hear about paleo.
And before we get right to the book, Daniel, your background, especially as a chef, and then just your career in television and writing books and stuff like that, did you always think that you were going to be a success that you are today when you started?
You know, I had a passion and I had a drive, and I never knew where it would take me, but I knew that I had enough of a message that I was out there working hard to get it going. So I started in London. I did cooking shows and travel shows, and I had lost weight, and I knew that when I heard all these chefs say fat is flavor, I just didn't agree. And I realized that I loved the food I ate, and I ate better rather than eating the junk food when I was fat. And I had a passion, and I did it. And, you know, I never thought I would end up designing menus for hotels or airlines, but I stuck to the healthy. I stuck to what I believe is healthy and help people with weight loss. And, you know, 10 books later and moving to the States 10 years ago, I really enjoyed the message, and now being able to be a spokesperson, be on Shop HQ in 87 million homes, it's a great message to have. So it's a dream fulfilled, but it's a hard work. It's not something that I kind of don't pay attention to. I try to do as much as I possibly can to pick every kind of way that food is eaten and how I can help different establishments develop that.
And as an author, Daniel, discovering the paleo diet, tell us specifically. I mean, you said you were struggling as a chef. Sometimes we do eat a little too much at times because you're a great cook and you're stuck always in the kitchen at different times. So when you did drop the weight, how did you discover this paleo diet?
Well, I only actually got into food because I lost weight. I was a teenager. I was 65 pounds overweight. Well, overweight that I am now. That, you know, now I feel like I've been a goal weight for 20 years. But I was a teenager and I was unhappy. And all that was out there at the time, it was in the early 90s, late 80s, fat-free. And it sounds so boring. It sounded so awful. I was having baked potatoes and pastas with no flavor. But the weight was coming off. So I wasn't feeling like I was hungry, but it just wasn't that exciting. And then I went to Thailand, and I found great flavors. And I suddenly realized you could collaborate that with food. That's how I started getting into the food and just thinking I'd do it for me. And about a decade after that, suddenly realized, you know what, I can do a lot more than this. I can actually teach people how to create food interestingly. So that's how I kind of got into it. And the fat-free is what I really focused on, but the Then it evolved into more getting rid of the carbs because the carbs don't feel good. And then I suddenly read on the paleo, which was brilliant. It was really, paleo means it's the, they call it the caveman diet. Paleotic is how we evolved. And when we stopped at fruit or we stopped at a carcass or we stopped, we found food and we ate it and it's raw and we ate it in its ways. Not the raw diet, but it's about having food at natural without the rubbish in it. And that's the beauty of this diet is you've got the 80-20 rule, meaning you can have 20% off, but it's 80% following it. Take out the pastas, the rices, the wheats, the carbs, and wheat is the real danger in this, and that's why so many people have gone to gluten-free. So this covers gluten-free, and that's what's good about it.
Daniel, one thing that I wanted to ask you was the controversial thing about fat, which some people are high on fat, other people swear that it's the cause of all heart disease. A friend of mine, a doctor, in fact, read a Wall Street Journal article recently calling into question some of the 1950s and 1960s research that reduced the fat in the standard American diet, according to Food and Drug Administration. What have you come across in this area in your career?
Well, I mean, you know, if we go back to 50s and 60s, you've got to look at portion size then, completely different. There's nothing wrong with fat. There's nothing wrong with how French people eat, but they don't have the portion size we're now accustomed to. So I think we've now got to tackle the animal of the size of the food and how that now is manageable. And I think by taking the fat down is the way that we can then still keep the portion sizes where it's normal for us. So I think that's the biggest issue is how we've changed that. Yes, the most ideal way of eating is, as any nutritionist would say, small portion size with a little bit of everything. That's not going to hurt anyone. But we've just gone too far away from that.
I agree with you. What I've found, and you can confirm or deny this, this is purely anecdotal from my recent change to a paleo-type diet 2 months ago, is that I've been able to actually eat less food because the fat content in my diet is much higher. I don't think it's an unhealthy level, but I know from my own perspective, if eating more fat just fills you up.
Well, I mean, protein fills you up, and it depends what kind of fats you're having. Paleo, yes, you can have coconut milk and coconut oils, almonds and almond flour. You know, I didn't always want to go down the high-fat side when I wrote the book because I still like the lean on it, but I think that you can get the same satisfaction from proteins, and that fills you up. But I think the main key on paleo that is my attraction into so many people is we don't realize where wheat is and what wheat is has been changed. Because in the 60s, that's where it was genetically modified and it was changed. And the plant was changed so it grew quicker, it grew in different climates, and it just really changed the way this is in our bodies. And our body doesn't react well to it. And that's why people, they're not celiac, a lot of people, they're just gluten intolerant because we don't, it doesn't do our body any good. It can make craves and wants you to binge eat, and there's a lot of things in wheat that it doesn't make us feel good. Now, when you say, oh, we'll take wheat away, you think, oh, that's easy, but then you don't realize it's a pattern so much. It's done in like tomato ketchup. You'll see it in salad dressings where you wouldn't even think wheat is, and that is what I think the beauty about this diet, taking that away, because that's the one thing I never really realized how bad it was for the body.
I have still learning this paleo diet in so many ways. And I see at times, Daniel, when I do cut out wheat and I do cut out some of the carbs, I feel better. You know, it's kind of funny. I'll go in, if I could go ahead and have a hot dog and just take out, you know, the bread, I feel full and I don't feel sluggish in certain ways. So for our listeners out there that are still understanding this, Blake has a good knowledge of this. You have a tremendous knowledge of this. What would I do in like on one meal for a paleo diet? What would I eat? Especially I'm 6'10", 280 pounds. I'm not fat, but I'd like to drop a couple more pounds and I'd like to get more lean muscle and get, you know, get some of the gut out and stuff like that. What recommendations would you have for like one meal? And that would really give people an understanding of, you know, picking up your book, purchasing your book, and learning about it. Yeah.
It's very easy. I mean, all you've really done is you've just taken away what you've said is 100% right. You have the hot dog without the bun. So what I'm saying is have the roast chicken, have the whole roast chicken, have a steak, have seared tuna, have that, but you don't want the potato and you don't want the rice and you want salad and you want freshness.
I love that.
And you want to add that. And it's just putting some more flavor in it. So a little bit more thought. So there's nothing wrong with making a Thai curry on the paleo diet. I made a simple 1-2-3 recipe with a Thai curry that takes less than 10 minutes. And it's just about adding more flavor where you wouldn't. So add some more chilies, add a little bit more cilantro, add some ginger, you know, add some things that are great flavor, and marinades and barbecues and grilling. I mean, it really is. I mean, I think of it as Atkins healthy, because Atkins was almost there and it was taking away the too big a portion of the carbs as well as the meat, but they just put the unnecessary fats and you could have dairy on it. So this is just a bit more of a healthy way of doing that. And I think it's pretty easy to follow. But the other thing I love about the diet is it's how I've lived my life. It's the 80-20 rule, which means you don't follow it 100%, because if you follow it 100%, I can promise you, you'll fail. You can't do that because you'll want to come off of it. So enjoy it Monday to Friday. Don't waste the time. Have the roast chicken, have the beef, have the steak, have the tuna, have what you need. But on the weekends, then go out, have some fun, have a few drinks, go out and have, you know, Chinese food and have all the gluten you want. But just make sure you do that once or twice a week and you don't feel that you're on a diet. You just feel you're on a plan that works.
I like this, and I honestly am going to talk to my wife about this, because I like these ideas, and I'm going to definitely let Blake chime in a second. But I mean, when I tell my wife I'm a big steak, I'm a big, and I don't like seeing the carbs. When I get a nice steak and a salad, I'm golden. You don't.